Good afternoon, and welcome to the EMIR Regulation Question and Answer Session. The speakers today are Anne Fourcheux, Head of Capital Market Initiatives, EMIR Area Covered, Implementation of EMIR from an IT and Operations Perspective. Aline Delenier, Fixed Income Trading Business Manager, EMIR Area Covered, Coordinating EMIR Implementation for Fixed Income. Nicolas Metat, Head of Derivatives Policy and Development within CIB Legal, EMIR Area Covered, Legal Implementation Documentation. Anthony Hainsworth, Senior Lawyer in BNPP's Regulatory and Advisory Team within CIB Legal, EMIR Area Covered, Regulatory and Advisory. The following Q&A session reflects BNP Paribas' views on the topics addressed, though we must stress that this does not constitute legal or regulatory advice, and we recommend you address legal or regulatory concerns to your own advisors. The following questions are on substitute compliance and third-party countries.
Within a group, are non-European entities subject to EMIR? What if they only trade with a local bank?
All entities dealing with a European entities are subject to EMIR, but if they are only dealing with a local bank, EMIR does not apply. I mean, this is the way EMIR has been designed, I mean, to reach out to all European entities.
What happened with US entities that are already subject to DFA?
Well, that's a tricky question for the moment. As you know, yes, US entities are already dealing with, subject to DFA, and if dealing with BNP Paribas as a Europe entity, we are also subject to EMIR. So basically, normally, we should apply both regulations. However, currently, the regulators are looking at this aspect to allow what we call substitute compliance, i.e., to have a way to agree amongst each other the equivalence between the two regulations. So for the moment, both regulations should apply, but later on, maybe we could choose between one or the other.
When we compute the clearing thresholds, should we include intragroup transactions? To who do we need to communicate our classification once defined, and how?
When we compute the when computing the clearing threshold, so this is only for non-financial counterparts, intragroup transactions should be included. And however, the deals done within the same legal entity between two different activities of the same legal entity or its branches, this one are not to be included. And the classification is to be transmitted for non-financial counterparts that are reaching above the clearing threshold are to be submitted to ESMA, the European regulator, and to the local regulator that you are depending on. Otherwise, I mean, you do not need to specifically inform your regulator. It's only whenever this threshold is which when you think that you are above the threshold or if further down you you change this threshold again that you need to tell your regulator. But whenever you communicate with your counterparts, I mean, you may be requested to verify about this this status. So please please communicate about it. This is on a voluntary basis. And there is also an ISDA protocol that has been written on this purpose to avoid to have to repeat to all your counterparts this information. So either way, on a bilateral basis or via an ISDA protocol, you can communicate with your counterparts.
The following question is on LEI.
What is a LEI and how do I obtain one? Do we need a LEI when trading between two entities of the same group?
So an LEI stands for a legal entity identifier, is now compulsory and mainly for the trade reporting obligation that should start on OTC derivatives early next year. You obtain one, each regulator as normally is starting now to look at how to offer. In France, for example, it's INSEE. In London, it's London Stock Exchange. So you can have an access. It could be created country by country. And there is also a global registration for European entity called GEI, a website on the where you can register your ADI on internet. But definitely, that would be compulsory for the reporting. And whenever you're trading between two different entities of your group, if it's two different legal entities, you would have to have also two different ADIs, and you also have to report both.
The following questions are on timely confirmation.
What constitutes a confirmation? Can an electronic confirmation constitute confirmation?
The key test of an effective confirmation is whether the intended method would amount to a legally binding agreement between the parties on the terms of the relevant OTC derivative contract. Not only is electronic confirmation permissible, but it is actively encouraged by the regulation, which specifies that parties should confirm their transactions by electronic means where available. This could include, for example, confirmation through electronic confirmation platforms such as MarketServe or SwapsWire, where both parties were a member of the relevant platform. According to interpretive guidance issued by ISDA, this obligation does not imply an obligation for counterparties to ensure that they are able to confirm via electronic means in relation to all types of transactions that they may enter into, where electronic means of confirmation may be possible. Parties may, in practice, have legitimate commercial or other reasons for not being a member of a confirmation platform. At this stage, at least, we are not aware of any regulators requiring counterparties to become members of electronic confirmation platforms, although this will be something to keep under review in the future as the market develops and the use of confirmation platforms becomes more prevalent.
Regarding timely confirmation, portfolio reconciliation and dispute resolution, what kind of reporting to regulators will have to be done and by who?
So each regulator is asking country by country for reporting. For timely confirmation and portfolio reconciliation, that would start on September figures. So that would be the first reporting. Timely confirmation at the moment is mainly for banks to be to report, and that also depends on the country. And but portfolio reconciliation and dispute resolution would have to be reported to the regulator. Only on portfolio reconciliation, we would put the name of the client if we have a dispute with that client. And otherwise, I mean, the regulator can come and ask at any time any details about our compliance with EMIR on those aspects.
The following questions are on portfolio reconciliation, dispute resolution, and portfolio compression.
In order to meet the portfolio reconciliation and dispute resolution risk mitigation techniques under EMIR coming into force on September 15, 2013, is it sufficient to adhere to the appropriate ISDA protocol?
To answer this question, I'm going to use a couple of acronyms, PR and DR, Portfolio Reconciliation and Dispute Resolution. The ISDA DRPR protocol is designed to meet the requirements set out in EMIR for written arrangements and agreed detailed procedures in relation to PR and DR, respectively. But I would note this needs to be aligned with operational requirements primarily, and these are the major focus, particularly in relation to Portfolio Reconciliation. There's some very useful FAQs on the ISDA website, and they spell out the workings of the protocol. In terms of PR, there are two alternative methods provided. The first is exchange of portfolio data. Under this approach, both parties send to the other a data set containing the key terms of the relevant transactions between them. The parties then undertake a comparison of their own records against the data received. Any discrepancies identified the party making the comparison can notify them to the counterparty, and then the parties consult with each other to try and resolve the discrepancy or discrepancies identified. The other approach is one-way delivery of portfolio data. Under this approach, only one party sends the information to the other party, and the receiving party reconciles it against its own records and is then entitled to raise discrepancies for further investigation. If the receiving party doesn't raise any discrepancies within a 5 joint business day time horizon, it's then deemed to have affirmed the data received. I suppose there's one caveat to be borne in mind. If both parties identify themselves as receiving entities, then either one or both of the parties would have to agree to act as a data sending entity for this particular relationship. Otherwise, an alternative portfolio reconciliation method will have to be agreed bilaterally. However, Paribas will be sending a data sending entity, and so this concern shouldn't arise for our counterparties who adhere to the protocol. One final point, I guess, is that one or both parties can use a third party such as Trioptima to undertake the portfolio reconciliation with the other party's agreement. And this agreement may be existing, for instance, where both parties have already signed up to the relevant Trioptima service. On the DR side, the protocol sets out a method for identification, monitoring, and resolution of disputes without overriding existing dispute resolution methods. The parties have already agreed, and for instance, there are dispute resolution methods under the credit support annex. The requirement for a specific process for disputes, not already resolved within 5 business days, is also covered in the protocol wording. But we should also keep in mind that parties can attempt to resolve disputes at an operational relationship or other level as well. Finally, I would note in passing that the requirements relating to compression are primarily internal to each party, and so they're not subject to an obligation to have them agreed between the parties. And so these aren't reflected in the ISDA DRPR protocol.
Can a non-financial counterparty, which does not have a master agreement in place, adhere to the protocol?
The protocol is wide enough to cover long-form confirmations in place between the parties, such as those referring to the ISDA form. One point to bear in mind, though, is adherence to the protocol won't cover further LFCs after adherence by both parties. So bilateral contractual provisions would need to be put in place for those transactions, and these could be included in a master agreement, which the counterparties subsequently agree.
Putting yourself in the shoes of a NFC client, if a financial counterparty does not adhere, what should we then do?
I suppose in those circumstances, and same as with any other counterparty, you would need to seek or agree the necessary details and documentation on a bilateral basis, or perhaps seek to persuade the counterparty to adhere to avoid this bilateral requirement.
Is the ISDA protocol limited to ISDA documentation, or can it be used where we have other derivative agreements in place?
Yes, the ISDA protocol is wide enough to cover not only ISDA documentation, but also what is termed in the protocol a covered other agreement. This is an agreement which sets out or governs the terms and conditions of a transaction in derivatives. The term excludes non-ISDA master agreements which have similar terms already in them, and an example would be existing FBF documentation, where an additive technique addresses risk mitigation techniques requirements under EMIR. It's worth noting the protocol only covers agreements which have been entered into prior to the implementation date as defined, and that's defined as the date on which ISDA accepts the adherence letter of the second of the two parties involved to adhere to the protocol. These adherence acceptance dates are reflected on the ISDA website. I suppose one final point to note on this topic is that agreements which have third-party guarantees are also excluded from the coverage of the protocol unless the guarantor has given any necessary consents or indeed has itself adhered to the protocol. This is designed to avoid a situation where the effect of the parties to the agreement making amendments without the consent of the guarantor may have the impact of discharging the guarantee.
Please, could you explain how the revocation provisions of the protocol work?
Once a party adheres to the protocol will apply the covered agreements which the party has with any other adhering party. However, a party can stop that being the case by giving a revocation notice to ISDA between the 1st and the 31st of October in any year. If it gives that notice, then the protocol will not apply to any parties adhering after the 31st of December of that same year, but it will continue to apply up to the 31st of December.
Please, could you explain the impact of the confidentiality waiver clause in the protocol?
The confidentiality waiver provision is designed to assist parties to comply with regulatory requirements under EMIR without being in breach of confidentiality restrictions they may otherwise be under. There's a general carve-out for transaction reporting under Article 9.3 of EMIR, which will address the issue from that perspective where both parties are EU entities, but this doesn't address the reporting requirement, for instance, in the relation to timely confirmation timelines or disputes that are more than €15 million and which have been outstanding for at least 15 business days.
If we have not signed up to ISTA protocol or otherwise put in place a bilateral agreement relating to PRDR with you by 15th of September, what is the impact?
I think the strict reading of the regulatory requirements is that the relevant agreements and procedures must be in place to enable trading to continue post 15th September. But that being said, I think a very important consideration is the view taken by the regulator of the party in question. As a general matter, there seems to be informal views being expressed by certain European regulators that the focus must be on getting the necessary agreements in place as soon as possible, even if trading is to continue after that date without the agreement in question being in place. From BNP Paribas' perspective, whilst a general matter, we will be prepared to maintain our trading relationships. I think we would, it's fair to say, would wish to have the agreement in place, which actually that may be best achieved via adherence to the protocol, or at least to understand what is still needed from our counterparties' perspective for the relevant agreement to be put in place.
What is the difference between a discrepancy and a dispute?
The difference is all in the context. A discrepancy could include any difference identified by the portfolio reconciliation process. The PRDR protocol does not require a party to notify its counterparty of any discrepancy identified through the portfolio reconciliation process unless such discrepancy is material to the rights and obligations of the parties under the relevant transactions. Some discrepancies, for example, in the valuations that the respective parties apply to their transactions, could have non-material differences. A material discrepancy that is not resolved to the satisfaction of one or other of the parties, and which one or the other wishes to pursue further under a more formal procedure, could, in contrast, form the basis of a dispute.
Is there a specific financial threshold over which a discrepancy becomes a dispute?
The PRDR protocol provides for a euro 50 million threshold for 15 days as a guideline. However, this does not prevent parties raising disputes in relation to smaller value discrepancies, noting that, as the market moves, what could be a small discrepancy one day could be a larger discrepancy on another day. With that in mind, counterparties can, of course, determine different internal thresholds above which they may choose to raise a dispute, which need not match.
If both parties have already adhered to the ISTA portfolio reconciliation and dispute resolution protocol, is there anything else to do in order to comply with portfolio reconciliation and dispute resolution obligations?
By adhering to the protocol, both parties have agreed on the arrangement under which they will undertake portfolio reconciliation. BNP Paribas will then be able to trigger the first reconciliation before the end of the agreed reconciliation period. No further action is required from our clients in that case.
What are the fields that will be reconciled?
BNP Paribas intend to follow the operational guidelines agreed in the ISDA Portfolio Reconciliation Operational Working Group. The document specifies that the reconciliation is centered on the mark-to-market valuation, the legal entity name, and the unmatched trade details. Other relevant details will be used to identify each particular OTC contract. In this regard, the minimum market standard, MMS, will be considered as the best practice template for the industry.
What happens if we already reconcile our portfolio with you?
BNP Paribas operational team will first check if the parameter of the reconciliation currently processed match EMIR requirements as described in the legal agreement that is in place between us. If the frequency used is different from the one required under EMIR, we would either change it if the current frequency is lower than EMIR frequency, keep it as it is if the current frequency is higher than EMIR frequency, or even set up a separate reconciliation if the client requires it.
What is the UTI and why do we need it?
The UTI is the unique trade identifier that will be used by the industry to report and match trades under EMIR. As the UTI format is very similar to the USI format, which is used for CFTC trade under Dodd-Frank, the USI can be used as UTI for EMIR obligation.
Who is in charge of generating it and how is it done? How is it communicated to the counterparty?
BNP Paribas intends to follow key principles set in the ISDA white paper available on the ISDA website. The basic principles are, as explained before, if both parties are swap dealer or major swap participants and subject to DFA obligation, the USI can be used as UTI. If the trade is done through an electronic execution platform or middleware, this platform will generate the UTI and distribute it towards both parties on the transaction. In other cases, like voice trade or paper confirmation, parties will follow what they call tiebreaker rules, which are basically rules defined on a product type basis and that define which party of the trade will generate the UTI and then communicate it through the confirmation.
Does BNP Paribas also have an internal procedure around dispute resolution?
Yes. BNP Paribas already maintains procedures for the reasonable and prompt handling of counterparties' complaints and keeps records of such complaints and their resolution. These arrangements are, in effect, complementary to those under EMIR. In the event that a client is, for whatever reason, dissatisfied with the service they receive, they should in the first instance discuss this with their regular contact at BNP Paribas, for example, their relationship manager. If you are not satisfied with the way your complaint is dealt with by your contact or wish to elevate any particular issue, you should contact our compliance department.
Are hedging transactions exempted under EMIR? More specifically, do we have to reconcile and report hedging transactions?
Hedging transactions are only exempted from the calculation of the clearing thresholds. All other EMIR obligations remain valid for hedging transactions, including portfolio reconciliation, dispute resolution, compression, and trade reporting requirements.
The following questions are on trade reporting.
Do I need to include both cleared and uncleared trades in terms of reporting?
Yes. The reporting requirements will extend to all derivatives transactions entered into by parties subject to the regulation, including, for example, both cleared and non-cleared trades, and also both exchange-traded and OTC-negotiated trades. Note, however, that the phase of the different reporting requirements may differ depending on the type of contract in question. Whilst, for example, mandatory reporting of at least some OTC trades, such as interest rates and swaps and credit default swaps, is due to be phased in on the 1st of January next year, ESMA have recommended a potential postponement of reporting of exchange-traded derivatives until the 1st of January 2015. It will be important to monitor developments in this area, including in particular whether the proposed postponement of reporting of ETD is accepted by the Commission.
Have some trade repositories been already authorised? Do I need to report to a trade repository in my own jurisdiction?
Okay, for the moment, no trade repository have been validated or accepted by ESMA. A lot of trade repository have filed to obtain the license. I mean to be authorized by ESMA. But we expect that by the end of September, ESMA will publish a first list of trade repository authorized, and for which, I mean, we would be able to apply for that. This would also trigger the reporting date, the start of the reporting date, because, I mean, we would have then 90 days after this the trade repository have been validated to start reporting. We do not know how many trade repository ESMA would validate. We expect at the minimum two, and but we don't know in which countries they would be based. You do not have an obligation, for example, if you're based in Poland and you have a Poland trade repository, to only go to the Poland trade repository. So you can adhere, you can send your trades to any trade repository accepted by ESMA. Again, too early to tell you which one, but we expect more information by the end of September.
Do reporting obligations apply to non-financial counterparties under the clearing threshold? Do we need to report intra-group transactions? Can you report on our behalf?
So yes, unfortunately, even if you are a non-financial below the threshold, you have a reporting obligation if you are a European entity. If you are a European entity, so you need to report all your trades. And again, I mean, the difference between if you have a trade within the same legal entity, you do not need to report it. But if you have a trade with another entity of your group and you do not belong to the same legal entity, i.e. you do not have a branch relationship, it's an affiliate, it's another entity of your group, those ones you also have to report those trades. Reporting applies to everyone in Europe. BNP Paribas offers the service of reporting for all trades that for which you face BNP Paribas. So whenever you face BNP Paribas and you request this service, BNP Paribas would be able to report. We've chosen to report those trades to DTCC as a trade repository, while this trade repository has not been yet authorized by ESMA, but we've been working with this provider for now some time for EMIR reporting. For the moment, BNP Paribas considered that this is part of the service offered around the deal, so that would come free of cost.
Thank you all for attending the EMIR regulation call. Distribution of this Q&A will follow shortly, together with a request for feedback.